Greetings there, this is Zifang, and with me is my co-host Lily.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Today we will be talking about Where Are My Children, a 1916 film directed by Lois Weber, and I think it's credited with also the her husband, Philip Smalley. I don't know why.
Yes, I believe.
But anyways.
He was assistant director, supposedly.
Anyways, yeah, so either way, it's directed by both of them. And it's a 1916 release. And it's one of the, I think, most dramatic film, documenting sort of the topics that is very sensitive for that time and era. And that's kind of the movie we're going to talk about this week. But in the meantime, did you have a chance to watch anything else in the meantime before we dive in?
You know, I really didn't watch anything this week, just basic YouTube videos, but nothing of real significance.
Did you keep going on that, what was that, Bewitched from last week?
Oh, no, I had to return it. But I just wanted to watch a few episodes. It was cute.
Yeah, nothing like the classics.
Mm.
I didn't really get a chance either. It's been pretty busy season myself. I did pop in. This is kind of what happens with me, and also last week too, is I kind of get some small bits of time when, you know, the family's asleep and everybody's sort of quiet, and just like a few minutes before I need to go to bed, I would pop in like a movie or something like that, or find something online and just take a few minutes and then just kind of watch a little bit of it. That's how I kind of take the ingest content these days. But I had an opportunity to get M for Murder by Alfred Hitchcock, which is not a silent movie.
Ooh.
But it's a classic movie. And I got the 3D edition of it because I recently upgraded my own theater and ended up getting a 3D projector so I can watch Blu-ray movies in 3D.
Ooh.
Which is interesting because there are a lot of modern 3D movies, but I didn't know about this, but in the past, they actually did a lot of 3D films natively. Like they had two separate lenses that they shot for 3D, and he did that. Alfred Hitchcock did that for *And for Murder*. And to watch older movies in true 3D is like astonishing. So I didn't watch a ton of it, but of the footage that kind of zipped around in, it was just amazing to watch old movies having that, you know, new technology. What we call new technology.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting, though.
Yeah, I mean nowadays, most recently. The time of this recording, it's 2019, so about maybe a decade ago, Avatar came out, or longer, I can't remember exactly, but somewhere around there. And that's the movie that popularized 3D, I would say. It had been around prior to that, in terms of the technology, but it was that movie that kind of brought that back. And most people, I think 3D, they think the red or green glasses or red or blue, and that's okay. But the problem, of course, is that that's only a small, slim fraction of the movies that were actually done that way. That was because somebody in the 1980s or 1990s, I forgot the details, but some documentary, somebody related to like Disney and when they're doing some 3D movies mentioned how it was not a good, you know. They basically insinuated all 3D movies are shot like that. And so since that era of time, by popular culture, most people, you know, until the Avatar movie came out, think of 3D movies, as, especially older 3D movies, as needing the red and green or cyan or something glasses. When in reality, that was not the case. So movies like *End for Murder* and *Creature of the Black Lagoon* and all those, there's about 50. 100 or something like that, or more movies that were natively shot in 3D, the way that like Avatar was shot, and many 3D true 3D movies are shot. So that's pretty interesting. So I'm in the middle of kind of acquiring them as time goes along.
Yeah. Because that's how I assumed 3D movies.
Right, because
you just wore the glasses. Yeah, it's like
you
exactly
still do have to
culture.
Wear the glasses. The difference between the glasses is that the best type of 3D is when you use the polarized 3D, which means you don't use the red ensign. Because, you know, in the modern 3D movies, if you go to the theaters, you don't use the red ensign, right? There's a mm-hmm. It's kind of darkened. It's like sunglasses. And it's kind of a technology is like a polarized glasses, where essentially you've got two separate projectors, or it's made in a way where there's two separate images that are a little bit out of phase, and that gives you the impression of 3D high level. So that's like the way it was shot, with two separate cameras, and a way that should be projected with two separate projectors as well. But anyways, side note now. So that was pretty interesting. All right. So without further ado, let's dive into this. Do you have any thoughts up front from the top, off the top, in the beginning? Any thoughts, comments, ideas just from the get-go?
Just before you even get into the movie, you just really wonder about the title itself, Where Are My Children? And, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt. You just wonder what – it's just really – it's one of those questions before the film actually opens, and you wonder what this tale is going to be. But they – I mean, that's really all I had. You just – I'm just trying to be general. You're like, where are my children? I don't know. Let's watch the movie.
Yeah, I think you're saying that it's an interesting title, right? It's a very – it draws people in. So even if you didn't see the poster, didn't know anything about the movie itself, you're just listening to the title, you're like, oh, well, now I'm interested, because what is this movie about, right? That's what you're...
Mm. But that's the only thing I have to start with it.
So in the beginning of the movie, there's a very... the top, even above the title, movie title, was Mr. Tyrone Power, which, did you look into him a little bit? He's one of the biggest silent film stars
too.
Of like all time. I mean, he's up there with all these popular ones. Lillian Gish we know, because we saw Birth of the Nation, and her legacy is, you know, we talked about previously, and she's definitely one of the well-known ones out there. And there's a other handful of people too, but certainly this is... as you kind of spiral inward into silent films, you'll slowly pick up on some of the biggest names of that time. You know what I mean? And certainly his name here.
Yeah.
And that's why he's above the title card. So that's certainly not by accident. So.
Because I didn't even realize that was... I don't know, when I first saw the title card, I wasn't thinking it was the leading actor. For right. some reason, I assumed it was someone to do with production.
You know, like, yes,
I
absolutely.
Don't know, even though it's like Tyrone Power Sr. in. And I was like, yeah. Who?
Yeah, he's certainly one of the I don't know if it's stereotypical, or maybe it is the typical sort of theater trained actors, which you almost had to be. There weren't really, maybe not, I don't know. Sometimes there were people that didn't act at all and went to the screen. But more often than not, most of them came from either the vaudeville or some sort of stage presence. And they slowly kind of worked their way up into the upper echelon. Then it wasn't even upper echelon. It was some sort of it was just a job for them, I think. But it's interesting to know that his name is above the title versus, you know, other people.
What comes after, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But so, what do you think of that opening, though, just before even any sort of people appeared?
Yeah, so a lot of reading, but it's what draws you in, and the beginning just shows Lois Weber using forced perspective with this idea of Heaven's Gates and the pillars. But at first, you're not really sure what that could be. You know, I mentioned Heaven's Gate, but it could, you know, you're just wondering what's going on with all the drama with the smog and clouds. It was an interesting...
I was thinking even before that, where the Universal Company, what is it saying?
Yeah, which is now Universal Studios. Pretty incredible. Yeah.
But they're also saying how they had to basically write some sort of disclaimer about what the topic of this movie is.
Mm.
It's like, well, this movie talks about birth control, and essentially it's like, in so many words, even though it writes a bunch of words about children seeing this without an adult audience and stuff like that. But it's interesting. It's almost like, at least politically, this is my guess. I didn't really have any facts backing this up. But my conjecture is that it's sort of like one of those, if you watch some DVDs and there's a commentary track or something, and then the studio, with like Fox, Paramount, you know, Universal will say, the commentary... you know, recorded for this movie is not the official opinion of the studio or something like that. So it's like Universal Film telling the audience using the text disclaimer saying, you know, whatever the views of this movie, we have nothing to do with it.
Right.
I don't think it explicitly wrote it that way. I'm sure these days they'll probably write it that way. But it almost like in so many ways is doing it that way. But I think it's because of the conservative nature of just the way culture was back then in the 1910s and teens that they couldn't write it that explicitly. So they had to kind of go around that. I don't know. That's my conjecture. This is even before the story begins.
I know it's very true. We think about what it was like back then, and they had to be very hush-hush. No one talked about anything unless it was through whispers. Yeah. Which is really crazy, because now everyone just explodes it all across the television.
Well, and social media, of course. But the context, I think, is like we've been talking about for all these silent films, is super important. What do you think of the context of essentially a very, very, in my view, very explicit sort of Judeo-Christian take on everything? It's very explicit, obviously, right? It's not like... hidden at all.
No, not at all. Which was really a fascinating, you know, starting point. It talks about social purity, birth control, and eugenics, and the idea of the poor being deterioration of the race. That's
that's
my notes and a quote.
That's certainly like, that's certainly the big chunk of the movie, and certainly much later. But the opening, and then kind of a theme throughout, a motif, if you will, but a lot of it is basically in the eyes of sort of the Judeo-Christian culture that America, even at that point, has, you know, you can trace it all the way back to the Puritanical days, you know what I mean? And just the culture at large, whether it's the Catholics or the Evangelical, it's just kind of the whole culture was so sort of that way that when a movie does it like this, nobody... bats an eye. I mean, nowadays, of course, this, you know, with our modern eyes, it can seem very out of date, out of touch, as it were. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like today, we're like, oh, what the heck is this? But I think if you were a person, an audience back then, you wouldn't bat an eye, because that's essentially every, like, at Sunday, everybody, or the weekends, everybody went to church and so forth. It was, I think, a big part of just culture back then to place it into context. So when a movie does this, and actually a lot of silent films does this, just without, they don't even apologize for it. It's just part of the culture. So when they tap into it and draw upon it, it just assumes that you understand it. Because it's just, that's how everybody lived, right? And so I think understanding that is super important, because if you understand that that's how people lived culturally in those times, and when you view this movie with that knowledge, then I think it works. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Because otherwise it's like, ugh, what's this? Like, this part makes no sense. You know? You know what I mean?
So. Yeah.
But you're right. That first opening with the gate and the composition is kind of incredible. I mean, it's only a year or so after the A Birth of the Nation was released, which obviously influences one another. D.W. Griffith. And also just, you know, now decades removed from the way you composition and do special effects and stuff like that. I don't know. Just, it's pretty amazing just from the get-go, right? That there's all these visual effects for a movie
because
that seemingly is about drama.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's just, it's, even though from the very few silent films, and you can totally correct me if I'm wrong, it's just a different start and opening compared to many of the others that had come before it. Because it doesn't start with people, it starts with a place, an object, and then it moves from there to create the story around it.
Yeah, I think you're onto something about the fact that silent films are a lot more sophisticated than we let them on to be.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, you know, there's this notion or myth that people have where older movies are simple, right? And it's not sophisticated. Well, as you can see with this movie, it's totally not true, right?
Mm.
The movies prior to 1910s, maybe a little bit, but only because, again, like VR tech and thing I keep reiterating, beating a dead horse, but they were definitely experimenting, figuring out how to communicate using film language visually, as well as all their other technology and techniques, on how to get across a message or a story. And sometimes it succeeded, and sometimes it's just really hard. And so I would say the movies prior to 1910s, it's kind of challenging to watch without a lot of research and context. And so, like, you know, when you first watched, it's like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that bridge thing, that, like, you don't even know if it's fiction or nonfiction or what is even going on sometimes in the shorts, in the movies that they're calling it. And so I think that is kind of the feature or pluses or minuses or pros and cons of the films in the first, you know, couple of decades of filmmaking, where they're experimenting and figuring out how to actually make it all work. And I think by the 1910s-ish, you know, when you slowly started to have more long-form movies, like movies that were beyond two or three reels, which is about, you know, 15, 20 minutes, depending on what speed they're projecting or are filming at. And you started getting into, like, you know, 8 reels, 10 reels, and just like movies like this, they're slowly sort of coming onto itself. Now, this movie here, of all the silent films that we've seen so far, because we've kind of been watching it sort of mostly chronologically, I would say, you can already start seeing the sophistication happen, where it's like you could almost watch this without almost any context and still grasp the story. Like, even if you didn't do all these research, you just, like, start watching cold, right? And you could still at least grasp the story. Like, you understood that there's sort of, you know, the overarching story of, you know, the abortion themes, you know, the children themes, the longing themes, the husband-wife relationships. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So, like, you could, at least using the film language that they have developed and evolved now for, at that point, you know, more than 15, 16 years, there's now a rhythm they've gotten into where they can actually communicate these things, whereas previously it was, I think, challenging to do that. You know what I mean? Like, remember
when you
watch, like, the Cabbage Kids, you didn't know, like, at least I didn't, like, there are these cabbage babies and they all, unless you read about it. Unless you figured out, oh, okay, like, there are historic significance to the meaning of that. Or if you were a person alive back in the era, and then you watched it, oh, they, yeah, that's, you know. Because you had a context. And when like, Alice Guy Blaché was making that short, her context was the audience of that time. And they would have picked up on that, right?
Yeah.
But we wouldn't, because we're now out of time and out of place. So that is to say, that's the long way of saying that this movie now is an example of already so many, even though it's still pretty early, by like the 19 teens, so much has evolved and developed, especially after the Birth of the Nation, that they're finally able to, just like a Birth of the Nation, they can communicate messages, ideas, themes in a very, very like sophisticated way. And this movie is not no exception, right? It's pretty sophisticated right from the get-go, right? Talking about how babies are coming in from heaven and, you know, it's popping in and out of heaven, I guess. So.
Yeah, exactly. So. It just, it's so, it's like such a fresh, not even a fresh idea, but, you know, trying to just explain it. It's like, I agree with the sophistication. It's gone from, you know, the early medium to just a whole other spectrum of what, you know, all these ideas. Yeah, makes sense. I might have just blurted that all out and just trying to think. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those just like right from the get-go, just the writing and this introduction of story, the fact that they introduced the idea of souls in heaven going down, and then once you abort the baby, it comes back up. Just that alone is like, I don't even know where that is from. I didn't really research it, but I'm pretty sure it's not like a part. It's not. It certainly isn't part of the normal, what I call normal evangelical mainline beliefs. And I'm not really Catholic myself, but I'm not sure if that is part of the Catholic one either. So it seems to be some sort of a made-up thing just for this movie, or maybe there's some previous idea that has set this precedence. You know, the idea that, you know, angels becomes babies and or souls, and then they kind of go back and forth or something like that. I don't know. The whole concept in itself is pretty interesting, just from the get-go. Even this is not even getting into the movie, right?
So, I know. It's a little bit scratching on the surface.
But just the beginning. I mean, it's pretty amazing. Movies like this is yet another reason why I love the silent film era. Like, even by now, you could see, like, many artists like Lewis Ober were in command of their movies. They could direct it. It's really sophisticated. It's kind of, like, polished. It's, you know, not like today, you know, technology-wise, but, like, for a story of that time, it's pretty good. And the fact that bits and pieces and chunks of this movie were lost, they had to restore it. It's pretty amazing. So, but let's keep moving on. After the titles were cut, there was something that I was confused about, because in the beginning, I wrote down that there was a quote, maybe not a quote, but there was a title, intertitle called Richard Walton, the district attorney, DA, was a great believer in eugenics. And then to the bottom right of that is Mr. Tyrone Power. Now, I was totally confused, because I was like, is that a dialogue spoken by Mr. Tyrone Power? Like, to me, in my mind, I was like, is Mr. Tyrone Power a character, like a fake character, fictional, in this movie? I guess this is the character, because I haven't seen this movie before, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought that Tyrone Power is the character in the movie, but he's not. Essentially, this title saying the character's name is Richard Walton, which is the DA, and he believes in eugenics. And he's played by Mr. Tyrone Power, but it doesn't say played by. So I was really confused.
I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, I was like, I read that, and I had to go back and pause and thought about it. Cause I had I didn't connect in my brain, you know, and not all silent film titles. And to be fair, I don't really know if this is the original title card or if this is a interjected one. Sometimes I can tell. I don't know if it is. I don't really know. But if it was the original one, it needed more context, I think, to figure that out. But maybe the audience didn't care.
Yes, that is strange.
Yeah, maybe the audience didn't care. It's like, yeah, it's one of the same. I mean, it's the same actor, so. Playing character. But anyway, I finally figured out Richard Walton is the DA, which is the character played by Tyrone Power. So he's the main guy. Anyway, moving on.
But yeah, it just starts off with him. He, as a district attorney, he's taken this man to court for his ideas about birth control being in a book.
Right.
And this, I don't know if it was just because of the time and era, but I didn't understand why he was just so angry and against it. I mean, he wanted children, that's one thing, but he was very sour towards, the character was very sour towards anyone who didn't want children or thought they didn't need to have them. But that's all to do with the context of the era as well.
Oh, absolutely.
People's minds were different.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
And it's just, yeah, this movie's great because I can't wait to talk about it a little, you know, once we've talked about it, of course, but just how it relates so much to now and the things that are happening in the country.
Yeah, and the movies, this movie is still, it's still very topical currently. Like, movies now don't even talk about subjects like this.
No, and that was one of the main reasons it's so it's important.
Yeah, it's still relevant today. And it's like, yes, it was, you know, 1916 or whatever, you know, 1914, 15, however long they made it back then. But imagine, like, having filmmakers today trying to make a movie about that. And there has been many, I would say, but I feel like not enough and not enough in the popular consciousness. There's a few out there by, like, Romanian filmmakers. There's a few of them. I forgot the name. This is, like, 4 months, 3 weeks. There's a film title called 4 months, 3 weeks, something. It was about, like, back alley abortion or something like that. So there's a bunch out there, but they're not, like, mass entertainment. Now, this was a really big one for Loza because she had already become sort of a very popular actress and stuff like that.
Mm.
So her name and, of course, her empire, both of them, was enough essentially to sell the movie. And it was seen by a large amount of people to the degree where, you know,
they would ban
trouble.
It in certain
cities.
They
would get in trouble, right? So because it's so sensitive and topical, which is unheard of these days, I think, especially about this type of stuff. But
yeah,
I mean, I'm talking about, like, even now, like a mass studio movie. I mean, we wouldn't talk about stuff like that, especially Universal now, which is funny given Universal's history. Which is why it's so fascinating to me. It's like, especially now, as you're relating it to now, there's not a lot of these movies now that are very gung-ho about, like, oh, yeah, you know, women, filmmakers, women's, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we're the first. You guys aren't really the first. Because these women, these artists, they were the first. And they already tackled so sophisticated topics. And on top of that, they had the artistry to do it. I'm not saying the people nowadays don't have that, but like, have you seen that Ghostbusters reboot with all female?
Oh, the women,
cast?
Yes.
But even though it was directed by a man, but anyways, that's neither here nor. It's like there's this push of like, oh yeah, you know, empowerment, and then when you actually start seeing it, it was like, oh, it's kind of okay, you know, the artistry is not quite there.
Yeah, it really does seem to be like that. Anytime it's women fronted. I don't know if it's just men or a lot of people don't seem to be satisfied with it.
Right. Exactly.
And I really wonder why.
Yeah. So that's one of those topical questions. It's really much related to these movies, right? But getting back to the movie itself, one of the things that I took away from that I was constantly amazed at is just the technique, the direction, and just the filmmaking. It was so, so rich. And like I said, I don't know, like, how many, I don't know if there are books on this or somebody wrote behind the scenes and how this production works or the way she works. But man, she's a really good director if it's mostly her. Because again, her husband's credit, I don't know how much he did or how much she did, you know what I mean?
Mm.
So it's hard because I don't know if it's documented anywhere. Not like Alice Guy Boucher, which, you know, if you remember that Be Natural documentary, you know that she did most of it. And the other guy was just a flake, so.
Yeah.
So her stuff, which you haven't gotten to yet, but it's going to be, it's supposed to be amazing, which we haven't seen yet, but, which is why I'm excited to see that. But so for this particular thing, I don't know what the contributions are. I don't know if it's like 50-50 or something like that. But either way, I got to say the techniques are really, really good. Because just the way she shot different angles and perspectives, and the way it focuses on certain things, I just really found it really fascinating. The framing of the characters, I mean, they're all pretty good. So, but even if before we got to that doctor who was sort of condemned,
Dr. Malphit.
Yeah, well, yeah. Not the abortion one, the first one who was condemned by the court and stuff like that. Prior to that, I guess juxtaposition of the DA and his desire for children, as well, in contrast with the other characters. Was it his sister or something with kids?
I think it was his sister who had just had a baby.
So yeah, like nieces and nephews. That was pretty amazing, right? Like just the contrast that, mm-hmm. you know, he desired it and then, you know, they
wife
couldn't.
Didn't.
Right. See, at this point in the plot. And it was just like setting up that tension alone in a short amount of scenes is really brilliant. Like the command of doing that is, it's pretty modern, pretty sophisticated, right? For a movie of that era. And I don't know. I just, the whole concept too of eugenics, and if you read into that a little bit.
I did a little bit. It was a little strange, but as most things are.
Well, it's one of those things. Like, you start peeling back the onions, like, whoa, this is pretty interesting. Mm. Like, yes, we're talking about movies, but more often than not, these movies touch upon so many different subjects. And this is why I love movies, because it allows you to learn about so many other things that the movies talk about that you don't normally, you wouldn't normally, like, I don't normally sit around and go, oh, what is eugenics? Like, I don't normally sit around and think about that or read about it or research it, right?
Mm.
But through movies like this, it's like, oh, that's interesting. What are they talking about? Now, the only eugenics that I understand is through fiction itself, which is Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II. Or, you know, movies like that when they offhand sort of reference that term, you know, or science fiction or something like that. Now, of course, I know what the word means, but I don't know what they're referencing in this movie when they say, oh, they believe in eugenics. It appears to be some very specific topic, specific belief, set of beliefs. And so, essentially, it ties back to, even back to Plato, and, you know, in the classic era, and where they want to make sure that the best humans survive. So that, you know, if your genetics is not as good as other people, you don't deserve to live. Like if you're sick, if your family has a history of diabetes, you guys should never, don't have any more babies. Like you're done. So,
yeah.
And you, the family without diabetes, oh, you get to live. Just keep on procreating. No problem. But if you, like the other families, if they have anything negative that would contribute diseases towards humanity or something that was negatively impacting humanity, that's a no-go. And that's essentially very high level. I'm kind of dumbing it down a lot, but essentially that's what it is. Way back in even in the Plato days. And of course, when the Nazis got a hold of it much later on.
Oh, yeah, the Nazis.
Yeah, they went nuts over it. But then even before that, I'd say a lot of the emperors and stuff, probably the Greek and Roman era, probably did the same. They did probably the same practices.
Which makes sense with the Egyptian kings and queens. They would normally be siblings because they wanted to keep the bloodline pure.
That's absolutely exactly what I was going to. And it's like we often think about Nazis as the sole sort of most recent evil nature, except that throughout humanity, so much bad stuff has happened even before the Nazis. You know, they don't get to have a monopoly on evil, if it were. But anyways, so that's high level. This is kind of what eugenics is. And so when they reference that, that's essentially what they're kind of believing in, which even back in that era of time was very controversial. I mean, imagine if your own thought process was like that, and then people are like, wow, you think that way for real? So anyways,
you wouldn't make too many friends.
Yeah, yeah. Although with her movie and her perspective, you could almost see why they are going down that path because of the suffering of people, and specifically of like women and poverty and how children are affected by that. Right. And I think that's essentially the thing in the opening scene where the DA, the main character, is like, oh, well, these criminals, they keep happening. And what if we stop, you know, criminals and undisciplined, non-bridal person from procreating, and then that would end that? Because that's his perspective, of course, right?
Yeah, that's the best way we can kind of understand where they're coming from.
Exactly.
Because it's really just the one way you can understand. Right. I don't know. But
no, I thought it just, the art itself, the framing, it's really beautifully done. The lighting.
I like the tinted color of all of the scenes as well.
Of course.
That type of gold orange. It kind of, you know, it drew you in a little bit more, too.
Well, of course, it all symbolizes. The colors mean something. You know, it's also intentional. You know, if it's blue, it's sad, and green is full of life, and green, the gold, I think, is the more objective or more better times, I guess. I mean, there's all these colors and what they mean, right? And so when they use these colors, they tend to actually have a meaning, too, beyond just not black and white.
That's fascinating. I didn't even realize that.
Oh,
I had seen a couple with the blues, and I was just like, oh, that's neat, but I didn't realize they specifically
So the desire for color has always been there, and that's why they hand did it. Remember, like, I think we talked about in passing.
A few scenes in A Birth of a Nation, too.
Exactly.
They were in color?
Yeah. And they all have significance, and there's a reason why they're colored a certain color in certain ways. It's intentional. It's not just to add differences between one scene or another. So back to this doctor here. I think it's Dr. Holm. Dr. Weir Holm, MD, something. Homme. Anyways, he wrote a book about birth control. And so he essentially said, why doesn't the law help me instead of hinder me? So he's advocating for sort of the law to help sort of clarify some of those issues, which is interesting because this film is inspired by Margaret Sanger, I don't know how to pronounce the name, but she is sort of the person behind Planned Parenthood, you know?
Yeah.
So she's one of the, not like founder, but she founded the, what's it called? The American Birth Control League, which later evolved into Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
Anyways, so yeah, it's really fascinating that it's all taking place essentially around the same time, 1914, right around the movie itself. So this film is actually one of the reasons it's so big is it is also very topical because it must have been in the popular sort of cultural consciousness at that time. So it's also it's like the zeitgeist of the time too, because that stuff was happening. Like that woman was getting in trouble.
she got arrested.
Yeah,
I think
she had to leave
the
country.
The clinic opened.
Yeah. So the point is,
go ahead.
The point is, it's such a, it just so resonant. It strikes a chord even then, even though it is striking chord now. So it's pretty amazing that was happening.
And just continuing on with that too, I was reading some information about this time and era as well. I'm not sure specifically if it was the woman who got arrested. I already forgot her name. Sorry. But the one reason she was advocating for birth control was because women were just dying. Like, were dying during childbirth.
Oh,
and
right, yeah.
It was, yeah. So she's like, this shouldn't happen.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's just, it's like another battle of the sexes issue as well.
Yeah.
But that's another topic. Let's keep going.
that's a great thing about this specific movie is, and movies like this, is that it's not a single topic. It's such a, like when I was like, holy cow, it's like, there's so many things you can talk about. And like, it's not like a one thing. It's a variety of things, you know?
And she makes you feel for the characters, too, because you agree with Tyrone Power's character, but you also feel for his wife. I didn't catch her name, though. That's not Mary McLaren.
I think
that was the daughter?
Gotta look that up.
I think that was a daughter, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was another thing I liked about this movie, too, because I never thought one of them was right for what they were doing.
I think I both her name agreed. Was just Mrs. Mrs. Tarampa, that was it. Mm. Mrs. What's it called? Richard Walton.
Mrs. Richard Walton.
That's it. There was no name.
Hmm. Oh, boy.
Yeah. All right, sorry. Go on.
Nope, that was all I had to point out. It just the way Lois Weber drew you into the story, you feel for Mr. Walton, but you also feel for Mrs. Walton.
Yeah. But the background of that was pretty incredible. Like that first doctor, Dr. Holm, when he wrote that book, the reason he wrote it is because of the things he experienced. So he was in court. You know those scenes? The first one was like
the poor.
Yeah, and that is like heartbreaking, right? Because even though it's a movie, you knew that was real life too. Mm-hmm. Like then, I mean, even now, but even more so back then, because they didn't have all the medical technology we have today. Of stuff like polio, like all the basic vaccinated stuff that these kids just had to die because or get sick, get ill, and never get better because they had no... And even if that was available, they had no access either, right?
Yeah.
And so it's just like heartbreaking. So
I think during that scene too, did the child actually die? I think that's why the mother was crying.
Well, this is where it's still kind of the film language is developing, I think, because I wasn't 100% sure. But later on when I read about it, so what happened was this woman who had the child who was sick apparently committed suicide with the baby, and that was the scene where the cop... So the doctor itself visited the woman with the sick baby. But then when he left and he was on a bridge, he called for the police. The reason he called for the police because they had jumped over the bridge. So they killed themselves.
Oh my gosh.
So that was not very super clear unless you've read, I guess, in the background.
No.
Yeah. So that's like, what?
Yeah, that's just kind of throw you in there. Because I remember him, you know, it went from one scene to the next because you see him pointing over the bridge and then there's the cop.
And that's
like,
why.
What's he looking at?
So that one woman and the child committed suicide. So dark, huh?
Wow.
And that's why the tint of blue, dark. By the way. So that's the one frame or scene, I guess, that's tinted blue. But even if you look at it, it's really dark, of course, but it's shot so well. Like the way that shot was, if you recall, kind of zoom back, it's the doctor, the police, but then there's this the stone rails of the bridge or something.
Yeah,
goes all the way from the front left all the way to the back right. That's what I'm talking about, is the framing. It just draws you in, like the whole angle and the lines of the art frame drew you into pointing towards the doctor, and it's amazing stuff. It's like Leonardo da Vinci stuff where they do mathematics to point you to things, perspectives, you know, mathematical perspectives. But anyways, so it's stuff like that that I notice because I really am into those things, that techniques of filmmaking and stuff like that. And as these filmmaking languages evolve and develop, those are the things that amaze me. It's like, it's so sophisticated even now, you know?
Because I remember that scene. I'll have to look at it again, though, to get that appreciation.
Yeah, so that's why. It's amazing. And then after that, of course, is the domestic abuse thing. And the acting is amazing. Like the domestic violence stuff. That must have been shocking even back then.
Yeah, because I definitely there's no rating. Any fight choreography. Yeah.
There's no rating. There's no MPA. There's no rating or anything, you know? So the fact that,
you know, just average violence.
No, but the fact that it was shown on screen, it was must have been shocking if you think about it. Like, a lot of this type of events happen, you know, behind closed doors. You don't, like, usually see it yourself. But the fact that, you know, now it's shown on screen is shocking. You know what I mean? You open the door and doctor goes in, right? Anyways, so moving along. Again, it's just like there's so much going on, you know? I loved how, you know, that they're with child when there's like an angel or something.
Yeah, that was an interesting idea. Superimposed.
I mean, now we, of course, we look at it and we're like, oh, yeah, it's, you know, a little bit over the top, over the head. But it's like back then, it's a nice special effect that denotes, communicates something without an intertitle. If you look at the film, there's actually not a lot of dialogue or intertitles, right?
Yeah, there wasn't as many.
Right, because you knew what that meant by just that little angel thing as well as all those other. And one of the things is like the way the frames are done is really amazing too. Like when they're in the court, the way that the DA is in the front screen, the foreground versus the background, and there's multiple things happening. Or like when the wife of the Tyrone Power character is welcoming that friend from a car, and it's just, it's an arch, you know, and arches make you remember things too better when you frame somebody in that light. Anyway, the whole thing, the whole technique of filmmaking is pretty amazing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just thought that all of that was pretty amazing. And then the next scene when the friends are gathered together, they continue to have multiple arches all the way from the right of the frame towards the back of the frame. It gives you, again, perspective. You know what I mean?
Yeah, this is something else I didn't notice. I definitely want to watch this movie again just to pick up on all these unique setups that I had. I would just watch the movie.
Right.
I need a better appreciation for it, but I'm also glad we're talking about it.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of these movies. It's like, it's shocking that they're doing all these things even before the term, the most popular term is called mise-en-scene. You heard of that?
Oh, yeah, mise-en-scene.
And that's at least 4 or 5 decades after these movies. Before the term was even coined, you know, they were doing these things. Which, you know, is different in movies compared to the theater, because in theater, in order to provide perspectives, you had to have like fake sets, like the sets, you have theater backgrounds, you have to paint perspectives into the thing. So if you've got this, you know, scene in the stage where they're supposed to walk in front of this long sort of narrow way or that extends into infinity, you have to paint that in as a background set or something, or figure some way to do it, right?
Oh, yeah.
But in the movies, you could just do it with the sets and or painting, too, I guess, if they're more theatrical. But the fact that they're intentionally doing that in the film and framing it, I think that's, like, the best arts. When the filmmakers are intentionally doing that and framing characters where they are in the frame, because it means something. Like, you know, if you got a character that's taller than the others, usually they got more power or they're more significant or powerful, and when they're lower, that means they're sort of victim-like. So there's all sorts of these things you can read into it just by looking at the frame, not even looking at the story of the dialogue. Because the reason why that's important is because all of that stuff is so subconscious that it totals up into, it contributes towards the final art of what you're feeling about this movie. Like, the reason why you often feel that this movie is so significant and hits you is because of all those little things, the techniques of filmmaking that helps you get to that point. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, Steven Spielberg is the perfect example. Because, yes, we know, like, E.T. and, like, he's got a bunch of movies that makes you feel something. But the reason why is because he does all of those things I just described so well. The film language, the techniques, and all that stuff. I'll give you an example of in Jaws, when the shark was finally sort of towards the beginning of the movie, when it starts to attack people, like when there's a ton of people on the beach and Roy Schneider, is it Rob Schneider? Roy Schneider? I can't remember which Schneider. He's sitting on the chair, and then there's a camera that zooms in to his face as it's zooming out at the same time. So
there's a
camera technique where, I don't even know the name of it, but you physically move the camera close to the actor's face, but then you zoom out at the same time. And it's a weird effect, but it gives you this feeling of like, oh no, what's happening? The shark is attacking. And like he, of all people, appreciate it because he's probably seen some of these movies. And, you know, all these movies have these film language that all little bits and pieces of that contribute towards the final goal of not just entertaining you, but giving you the effect of what you're feeling. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why this movie hit me a lot, because of all these techniques, and I would notice that. It's like, oh, wow, like the art is, every little bits and pieces is adding towards your experience of watching the movie, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But it's that way throughout the movie. I mean, I'm just pulling these things out, sort of. And of course, we get to the, is it the brother? The wife's brother.
Oh, the very luscious brother. Yes.
Yeah, the luscious. That's right.
That's
with the mustache twitching, right? Yeah.
Oh.
And yeah, so he, you know, seduced the housekeeper's daughter, I think.
Yes. Yeah, so her name was Lillian. I got that part, at least.
Yeah, and of course they went through the. I mean, it can be a little bit melodramatic, I think, some parts in the story, at least if you were viewing it through modern eyes. But of course, back then, it was like just normal. When she died, that daughter character, it's still blue. I noted that. So it was gold, and then blue. Sad, right? So all these things.
Oh, that part of the scene. Yes, I remember that part.
Yeah, that's it's the blues. It's sad. So, But yeah, and what do you think about the ending? The very, very end. Zooming
very
to the end.
End.
Where the ghosts of the. The family? I mean, how, like...
That was very...
How crazy was that?
Yeah.
There's so many parts of this movie.
Different.
Even for a silent movie, I was like, huh. Like, wait, suicide? Wait, like, abortion? And what? And, like, how, like, you know, shocking, I think, is the word.
It was very shocking. It was different. And kind of going back to what I was mentioning before about the title, when Tyrone Power's character asks, "Where are my children?" I was just like, "Oh, that just hit me." Now I know what it means.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he's like, "What, you know, what did you do?"
But at the end, it was like the little sort of children. They're kind
of the ghosts of what could have
been. Yeah, like the Christmas. It's almost like the Christmas past, present, future. What is that called?
Like what you were saying, the ghost of Christmas past, present, and future.
The Scrooge story, right? Where they have things that could happen. It's very similar concept, where except they took it on with this story context. And he had like the grown children as ghosts.
Yeah, as they were ghosts. Adults.
I mean, that's crazy.
Themselves. Yeah,
but it's such a stroke
very
of genius.
Heart-wrenching.
Yeah, but it
really was.
It was that, but also it's like, wow, nobody has done that since that I'm aware of. That's pretty amazing for a 1916 movie, you know?
Mm.
So I think many parts of the movies holds up, even for modern audiences, you know? I think, and other than those smaller parts that you kind of figure out, like the suicide parts, it's like, it's just an amazing piece of movie, you know?
And you don't need to think about why it was a huge box office hit.
Right.
There's many elements that draw the audience in. It's women's rights. It talks about, you know, the subject matter that was controversial at the time. You know, there's life, there's death. And, past, present, future. It really is an incredible movie.
It is. It is. And the fact that you could just... Even if you remove the subject itself, like, the filmmaking itself is pretty brilliant. Like, it's really good framing. It's good camera work. It's good just editing. And I think the score, at least the one I watched had the score, was the original one that was performed with a modern orchestra, but it was the original score for the film. So,
yeah, everything seemed to match when I watched the film too. Yeah. It mirrored what was happening on the screen, so that was a good touch.
Right. Anyway, so yeah, it's one of those movies. It's like, wow, you know. Anyways, makes me always say like a old fart, like they don't make them like they used to. So, and for many reasons too, you know.
It's true. I mean, as we mentioned, no one's really touched the subject. At least, I'm not sure about it in America. You had mentioned Romanian films, but yeah, no one
European
has touched this idea since.
European films tend to have the ability to touch upon these subjects that are more often than are very conservative, I think. Conservative culture over here for that type of movies don't often get into, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's very taboo still, even today, 100 yep. years later.
Yep. So, any other thoughts, comments?
Just learning about who Lois Weber was just made it all the more incredible. She was a screenwriter, a director. I don't remember if she had her own company as well. I think it said she did. But it just, you know, it's also a very sad ending for her as well as with a lot of these people. They just basically died poor and alone.
Yeah.
And it just, I keep hearing about these filmmakers just having nothing at the end of their lives, and it just kills me.
Yeah.
Because they did so much for us now.
Yep.
I think it said she died of a bleeding ulcer at the age of 60, and I was just like, oh my God.
Although that's probably pretty common of that era too. Remember the life expectancy was much lower then compared to now. So.
I guess that's true.
Yeah.
I didn't wouldn't really
Not many people live past that, I think, around then. Now we're like 77, 80 and plus, if you're lucky. But back then, that's probably towards the tail end. Due to just knowledge of, you know, basic hygiene, you know, so and medical and stuff like that. What was interesting to me about her life was they had a daughter, Phoebe, was born 1910 and died in infancy. I wonder if that has probably a lot to do with this movie. That small little tidbit was screaming out at me after I watched this movie.
Possibly. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's, you know, and so that was 1910 and took her a couple of years, you know, write, shoot and stuff like that, 1914, 1915, and have this come out 1916. So. I found that was super interesting. But she, like Alice Guy Blaché that we talked before, not many of her films survived. In fact, not many. I mean, even though the silent film itself, up through the 1920s, most of the silent films are lost, somewhere around, like, you know, less than 10% survive. But of that number, less than that, probably, for the films prior to the 1920s. Most silent films that you can have access to and watch, Nosferatu, Metropolis, they're all the 20s, 1920s movies. They are accessible, more accessible than the films prior to 1920. Because when you start getting into 1920 and pre-4, then you start getting into like missing, you know, scenes, missing footage, missing stuff. Even this movie had a bunch of stuff missing that they had to reconstruct, you know? So, that's the sad part, is that as amazing as it is for these early women filmmakers, we can't even get to see some of these potential classics, right? This movie was a great representation of her skills, her artistic sensibilities, but man, if she started here, where does she go to next, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Like, what else is there? Like, and there's been a lot. Right? She's one of the biggest names in silent film. Certainly. Very, very big. And for good reason, you can see.
Yeah, and especially since they say she's America's first female director, there should be many, many more of her films
technically,
out there.
Alice Cooper is too, but yeah, that's you know.
Well,
splitting
yeah,
hair.
She's the American one. She's the first.
But I mean,
one.
Remember, she moved to America. Remember, Alice, so she also is the first American. I mean, if you want to place a meant, but again, like I said before, first. It's just so hard to use the word first.
Hokey pokey.
It is, mm-hmm. especially when you talk about these type of silent film artists from the get go. But yeah, like down the road, I do want to try to revisit her and maybe like that whole keynote release of early women in filmmaking and stuff like that. That sounds like an amazing collection to even have, you know, to put out. So.
Yeah, that'd be really exciting. Even just going off of last week, learning from Galaxy Blachet and her, you know, tying in with Lois Weber, it was very, they had a very unique relationship.
Right.
You know, she created Lois Weber, you know, discovered her from being an actress and beautiful and taught her how to be a director. And then from there, she just kind of, you know, went on her own course.
Right.
And had an affair. Whoops.
Yep. Well, yeah. Anyway, I'm sure that's unfortunately very common back in the day, just because everybody is when you work in like close quarters and stuff. It's unfortunately one of those things. It still happens today, I'm sure, in the film industry.
I bet.
But yeah, I mean, just amazing career, and this is just one of the many movies she's done. Like, I think I wrote down in 1914, she directed 27 movies. What?
Wow.
So, and by then, it's probably just as long as this one. This is like, you know, a
solid
hour plus movie. It's like 70 minutes. It's not like one of those 15-minute, 5-minute movies, the shorts. By then, they were making these feature-length movies already. And that's significant in 1 year, if you think about it.
And what's great, too, besides the missing parts of it, is it you never lost interest in the story. And right. I think having a great narrative sets you apart from a lot of other stuff as well.
Right.
Because, you know, with Birth of a Nation, I'm not sure if it was just the length itself to tell the story. It just seemed like a lot was lost in translation. With this film, you know, being 2 hours shorter, as we talked about, you could understand the whole film without really needing title cards.
Right, exactly.
You knew what was happening. You're just like, oh. So that's a great, you know, sophistication from just the very early stages, you know, 10 years, and then 10 years later, boom, you have this incredible film.
Right. But it's like a slow progression because she's constantly working. Just like many of her fellow early filmmakers in the production. It's just amazing the amount of output that all these, you know, women and men, but like for women, is pretty astonishing compared to what it is now. It's certainly much more, it seems like, than now. In terms of how involved they were, how entrenched they were in all of the industries. So.
But that's really all I have to mention. I think we, you know, dug around into this film pretty well.
Well, I think we did a real quick survey of it. I think we could just go on because just the one movie is there's just so much to it. Like you could, and people probably have written books about this and stuff like that. Just the topic itself, it's so sophisticated and complicated. And I mean, what a movie, right? There's just so much.
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot to go from it.
Yeah. But, anywho. Alrighty. Well, that, unless you have anything else to add.
Not particularly for this film, but I'm looking forward to watching more by Lois Weber.
Yeah. A lot of these early 1910s movies are pretty amazing. That's the thing is, I don't know if there are many films prior to 1910s are just as good as this. Because I think it's around 1910s and after, and certainly by Birth of a Nation, that it matured to a point where you could get to this point where it's reasonable enough to expect you to be able to watch it without too much research in the context.
Mm.
Whereas a lot of these films prior to 1910s were kind of a struggle, right?
Hmm.
So even like Trip to the Moon, Great Train Robbery, you could watch those, maybe. But it's still kind of a struggle, right? It's just, it's hard.
Yeah, here and there.
It's a much harder pill to swallow to try to figure out what is even going on in these short movies because they were starting out and because they're just figuring things out and experimenting. But certainly my 1910s is very much matured, you know? And it's crazy thinking about it. It only took them 10 years or 20 years, depending on 10, 15 years, depending on 1895 through 1910. Yeah, it's about 15 years to mature.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And it's, you know, amazing the progression.
Yeah. I mean, Ned Kelly, that's probably the longest one that we saw.
The Ned Kelly Gang,
Yeah, the Australian one. And that was already pretty amazing in terms of it could sell a story like that. It's still pretty hard to follow. But certainly by, again, 1910s, things got a lot more sort of able. You're able to comprehend it easier, I think. All right, cool. So that's about I think we can end it here. I mean, you could, again, there's so many things to go off of on just the result of one movie. But that's okay. We'll keep chugging along. For next week, let me check what's on our calendar here. We might be able to watch Body and Soul, maybe.
By Oscar Michaud, yeah.
Maybe that or Cabin of the Doctor, depending on how you can get it. But we can talk about that afterwards. So either way, once again, thank you for all the listeners who are hopefully continuing to subscribe to our podcast everywhere, available through Apple Podcast platforms or Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google, wherever you find us. Please leave a review. And then if not that, then at least a rating so that other fellow silent film fans can find us as well. And so that's the best way to sort of help us find newer audiences as well. And you can find our stuff at watchingsilentfilmsplural.wordpress.com. watchingsilentfilms.wordpress.com. Thank you, Lily, once again. And thank you for the listeners. And we're going to sign off.
Thank you, Fong.
Thank you.
All right, signing off.